Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
You've seen what's been going on in the city of Flint, Michigan. I'm glad that we're getting the attention that we finally deserve to have, but if you've been keeping up with what's going on, this is something that in April will have gone on for 2 years now, that we haven't had clean, affordable water in the city of Flint. Our kids have been damaged by this lead poisoning that's been going on, and what we've been doing is asking the governor, the state, to be accountable.
It's the mayor of Flint, Michigan, Karen Weaver, at a press conference on Wednesday in Washington, D.C., where she traveled this week to meet with President Obama and administration officials and was attending the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting.
This is something that nobody should have to deal with. Everybody should have clean water. You know, it's ironic when you live in the Great Lakes State and we don't have access to clean water. So this is something that it continues to be a disaster for us because we don't know at which point we will be able to drink the water.
A crisis with no end, says Mayor Weaver. It is this open-ended uncertainty that causes people in Flint, Michigan, to compare this water contamination with the long-term destruction of New Orleans from Hurricane Katrina. Except in Flint, the hurricane of lead poisoning arrived in 2014 and was invisible, dismissed by authorities and ignored by the media. Mayor Weaver was still a private citizen when she heard the first reports of questionable water. She was one of the few to take action.
Well, when I heard they were switching to the Flint River, I wasn't drinking the water.
Okay.
You know, that was just something. I made a conscious decision. All the way back when I heard, I thought it was a bad decision.
Uh-huh.
So I stopped immediately. I just didn't do it, and neither did my husband. And, you know, it's sad that I would say, thank God my kids are grown and not there, but everybody can't say that, and we shouldn't have to say that.
Mayor Weaver got elected to deal with the water crisis, and now she has a real ally in Lansing, Governor Snyder, who vowed this week to aggressively begin a cleanup and an investigation.
I want him to give us the services and the money and the funds that we need to address the population. If, you know, like I said, there's an investigation going on. I'm letting that investigation play out. I'm sure it's going to be more than the governor's name. You know, there's going to be a lot of people. And one of the things they talked about is you're going to see responsibility across the board. So we're waiting for that. We're waiting to see who knew what when. And then we'll go from there. But I've really, people have said how they want things handled with him. I'm staying focused on what I need to get from him right now.
But can Flint do anything on its own with all of its financial problems and a decimated tax base? Mayor Weaver says she and the people of Flint can make a lot of noise.
The question was, what are you going to do differently when you still have this setup? You're still in receivership. But one of the things I said that I would do and what I have been doing is speaking up and speaking out and being a voice for the people. Even if they say, we're not going to let her do that, I let them know that's what I'm going to tell them.
But Flint spent more than a year in the shadows, even though its water was poisoning small children. Does the mayor think a Michigan suburb like Bloomfield Hills or Grosse Pointe would ever have to go through that?
No, I don't.
No.
And they're not under emergency manager. We were. We were, so we didn't have a voice. And that act has not helped very well, especially in cities that are minority poor.
Thanks to our own Todd Zwillick for connecting with Mayor Weaver at the U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting in Washington, D.C. In this show, we're rethinking politics, life, business, and leadership in light of the Michigan water crisis. Will the name of Flint, a proud but beleaguered Rust Belt city, become another name for industrial runoff? Residents and business owners continue to cope with the impact of the poisonous water and the added stigma of being in a city once revered for its auto industry growth, now decried for harming its citizens. Let's hear from Ron Sims. He's owner of the more than 50-year-old Torch Bar and Grill in downtown Flint.
A lot of questions about how we're dealing with the situation downtown. We've had a few phone calls asking if we have bottled water. We use a filter. We put a filter in last fall. So most people, once we talk to them about that on the phone or in person, they come in and they seem to, once we explain the filter to them, to be pretty comfortable eating at the restaurant.
And when did you notice that there was a problem and that really there was going to be some impact on your business?
Well, when this all first started back in 14, you know, I heard there was reports of some neighborhoods that had discolored water, odors from the water, stuff like that. Where we were at downtown, I never noticed that. We never had an issue with that downtown. I started getting concerned last year when there were reports of elevated lead levels in the children in town.
Did you get your water tested? Did you begin to map where you were in the system and what kind of corrosion you might have been facing?
We did not get it tested. We just went ahead and got the process in and putting a filter in regardless of what the water was down there, just to be on the safe side.
So there are contractors in Flint who are working like 24/7.
I have talked to a few that they are working pretty heavily right now doing that, yes.
And what did they tell you? They said for this amount of money, here's what we can do. And, you know, what kind of filtering do you have?
Right now, a lot of them are handing out water and installing just the on-faucet filters for free, donating their time and some of the stuff around town. We spent some money on a whole building filter just to make sure that everything in our building was covered.
How much is it?
Ours was about $1,800 installed. They had to do some extra plumbing work to get it in, so it was a little bit more than probably most would have to spend.
So, you know, there's all this talk about the crisis being ignored and the health effects being really dismissed by political figures and the people who, you know, apologized. You got the governor and then, of course, the Department of Environmental Quality head who resigned at the end of last year. But from a business person's perspective, it's almost a sort of double whammy that this blows up after so many months. And now, you know, you've maybe taken care of the problem, but you're going to have questions for 10 years about people coming into your business, right?
Exactly. It's like we have probably even had less information directed towards the business community than the general population has. I don't think I've ever got anything saying what we should or any guidance at all from the health department. So yeah, we're kind of behind we were behind the curve this whole crisis. So it's been frustrating to say the least.
And here you are, one of the businesses in downtown trying to, you know, come back as Flint has been trying to do for, you know, 30 years now. What does this do to the, you know, the solidarity of the businesses who are trying to deal just with the economic downturn?
Well, you know, so far they're pretty optimistic between the new restaurants and other bars downtown and the new residents downtown. They're cautiously optimistic at this point after Tuesday. So we'll see going forward. They're going to have to have some pretty big actions going on from local and state government to like allay some of their fears. But right now it's cautiously optimistic after governor's speech on Tuesday night. So like you said, we're going to be living this for 5-10 years down the road.
What made you feel good about what the governor said? And tell me about your conversations with some of your business colleagues.
Well, I don't know if I really felt good about it. It was nice to hear that he finally acknowledged that there's some mistakes made over the last year and a half or two. One of the other business people I talked to recently, they've been, I think, hit harder than we have because they're more of an upscale and people just have a different perception of this, the establishment they had of ours. One reaction was the very cautiously optimistic that he took some responsibility for what happened in Flint and that hopefully we can get this addressed sooner rather than later. Another comment that I heard when we were sitting there watching it was, no matter what they said, they're still trying to beat the downtown further down. So it was a pretty big mix of responses to his speech Tuesday night.
It's interesting that the upscale restaurant is hit harder. I suppose people expect to be drinking poison when they come into a bar, right? I mean, that's sort of the idea. But that could have an impact on medical facilities and all kinds of, you know, clinics, that sort of thing. It just, you can't imagine anybody who's not had an impact here.
Well, that's just it. Every business, bar, restaurant, hotel, school has been impacted by it and will be down the road.
You know, when Michael Moore came to town, you know, there was some positive there, but he certainly ended up turning Flint into a kind of a joke to some people. And I'm wondering if this has the potential of, you know, the same old here we go again feeling. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was thinking about that last night. It does have that potential. But what I tell people, especially people coming like visit their kids at school or coming home to visit family. It's like, this is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, this isn't just possible in Flint. We, you know, a lot of communities, especially in the Midwest, have old crumbling infrastructure. If you're not paying attention, this is going to happen in your community. It does have the potential to be a joke, as was Michael Moore's film. But I think people need to realize that it goes beyond that. And if they don't wake up to the fact that it needs to be done, they're going to have the same problem we're having right now.
Are you opening today, Ron?
Oh, yes, I'll be open.
All right. And what do you, what's the special for lunch?
Today, we're known for our burgers. We don't run a lot of specials. The top selling is a bacon burger with deluxe and olives.
Ron Sims, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ron Sims is the owner of the more than 50-year-old Torch Bar and Grill in downtown Flint in Buckham Alley between West 1st and West 2nd Street.
I'm sorry most of all that I let you down. You deserve better. You deserve accountability. You deserve to know that the buck stops here with me.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder apologizing to the people of Flint and to his state on Tuesday night. Snyder is asking the legislature for $28 million in spending on diagnostic tests, health treatment for children and adolescents, replacement of old fixtures in Flint schools and daycare centers, and a study of the city's water pipes. Ron Fournier is from Michigan, but is now the senior political columnist at the National Journal, based in Washington, D.C. A profile column by Fournier about Governor Snyder late last year very suddenly became obsolete when Snyder was caught having ignored the Flint crisis for months. He interviewed Governor Snyder earlier this week for an update, and the governor told him that this crisis is his Katrina and that losing the public's trust has been among the worst experiences of his life. Fournier has also done some soul-searching of his own about how such a large city like Flint can just fall off the radar when people are being poisoned.
Why does a community like Flint get neglected? Why does a community of Flint allowed to be poisoned by its city, its state, and its federal government, and nobody seems to care until they get caught? Why is it that it took the national press so long to really get engaged in the story? Why has the President of the United States still not talked about the culpability of his administration? Why did it take Snyder so long to say, I'm sorry? Why is money still just dribbling into that city? Why is it that we're all in an uproar over the lead in the water when there's been decades of job losses and terrible schools and terrible crime problems? Why is the city of Flint allowed to waste away? It's poor. There's not a lot of power in Flint. There's not a lot of money in Flint. And we live in a society now where celebrity and money equal power. And if you have power, you get attention and you get what you need. If you don't have power, you get left behind. I grew up in Detroit, on the east side of Detroit, not too far from Grosse Pointe. I can guarantee you, if there was the whiff of too much lead in water, we would have been pumping in Perrier by the end of the day.
If you even knew what tap water was in Grosse Pointe, which is kind of the Beverly right. Hills of Detroit, of the Detroit metro area.
Exactly. Or on the other side of the state from Flint, Traverse City, a very affluent tourism area. There's no way Traverse City would go without clean water or anything that it needs. So that's an indictment on all of us. And one thing we have to be careful is that we, you know, this is a big and important story. You know, I spent a few days there and wrote some stories to try to bring some attention to it. But we can't forget about it. I mean, that's what happens is Flint gets forgotten. Places like Flint, my hometown of Detroit gets forgotten until it gets sexy for a while.
The Department of Environmental Quality head in Michigan, who resigned fairly quickly when this became a national story, there was no evidence, and I looked, of him making any remark whatsoever about this public health disaster over the entire 18 months. I looked on every YouTube, every speech, every quote that I could possibly find. It seemed like the agency responsible for this kind of contamination was not involved.
Well, they were involved. They knew that there was too much lead in the water, and they were actively playing it down. They were being dismissive of and even with an arrogant tone towards mothers and fathers who were raising their suspicions. They were involved in protecting their butts. They weren't involved in solving the problem.
Should the governor resign?
You know, I don't know. You know, every time, if every time we have a leader in this country who doesn't react as quickly and as honestly and as transparently as they need to a public health crisis, we would not have any leaders in this country right now because we have a systematic problem. It's a fair question to ask, but why not ask it also of the president? I don't think the president should resign, but it was his appointee, the head of the EPA in the Midwest, who buried the results. The EPA knew about this in as early as February, certainly by April of 2015. So I'm afraid that if they resign, then we forget about the story. And whether they resign or not, frankly, I don't care. I just want the lead pipes that have been decaying in that city for at least 30 years to be replaced. I want every kid who's going to have a lifetime of brain damage to have the services they can so they can live as decent of a life as they can with the lead that our governments put in their system. I want Flint to have a chance to come back as Detroit is now getting its green shoots of a chance to come back.
Do Flint lives matter in Michigan politics?
Hell yes, they do now. They didn't a few months ago.
Will they matter in a month from now?
That's what I'm worried about. I'm afraid they won't because the history of that state in this country is as soon as we move away from people who are poor and don't have a voice, their lives matter less, and they've got to matter. Flint is a great community. It's a great town. It's got a great history and hopefully a great future. And if we can't unite behind our horror for a city and a state and a federal government poisoning a great American city, if we can't unite and find some good in this, then we're not going to be able to unite around anything. But if we just – if this becomes another partisan issue where the Republicans blame the Democrats and the Democrats blame the Republicans, and that's all it is, and we don't move beyond any accountability, then shame on us.
Ron Fournier is a proud Michigander and the senior political columnist of the National Journal. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Residents of Flint, Michigan aren't the only ones feeling abandoned. Plenty of you see problems ignored in your own communities. Chicago. Humboldt Park is where I live, and when my daughter was very young, I called the police for excessive shooting outside my house. I gave them my address, and they said, "That's a shame," and hung up the phone. Even the police won't go into some neighborhoods in Chicago.
Hi, this is Lena from York, South Carolina. The roads are terrible here. There's litter everywhere. The schools are terrible, and nobody does anything or even cares. When Nikki Haley was running for re-election, she touted her roads program. The same road, Highway 5 bypass, has been repaved 3 times in 4 years. It's ridiculous. Meanwhile, several roads are so bad that people have complained and sued the county for damages to their vehicle.
Tell us a story, 877-8MYTAKE, or leave a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And forget the markets, folks. You aren't the one losing billions of dollars one day and gaining it all back the next. Think of what you'll be able to tell your grandkids if you check out instead. The confluence of planets, putting on a rare show in the early morning sky. Right now, for the first time in more than a decade, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter all visible at once. You can catch their performance just before sunrise every morning for an entire month. Grab your binoculars, or better. Jason Kendall is here, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. How easy is this to see, Professor?
It's very easy to see. I was just out there the other morning out in Inwood Hill Park in northern Manhattan, and I was able to pick out Jupiter really easy. I was able to pick out Saturn. Mars is dull and red in the low west, in the low east. As it just is very simple to see, even in the morning sky, and anyone can find it really quick.
So take your binoculars and get to high ground.
Well, I was actually able to see it from Inwood Hill Park, which is northern Manhattan, and Venus just comes up right between the buildings. But the thing is it's really, really bright. Yeah, you do need to be able to get to at least where it's flat, where you can see a good horizon, because if there's any buildings in the way, you won't see it, because nothing's above more than like 20 or so degrees. And a degree in the sky, if you take your fist at arm's length, that's about 10 degrees. So 10 fists on top of each other goes up 90 degrees. So
you need two fists of clear horizon get the full show.
The full show. And preferably if you can get out to a nice big open field, these big open parks are wonderful for it. And so you just need a good southern view. And because Jupiter is setting in the west in the morning, and then it's actually pretty easy to see. And they're kind of in a nice line. They're the brightest objects. There's a couple of stars, Spica and Antares, which are also up, which can mistake a few people. But they seem to be in a line, and they're very easy to find.
And this is great for the Midwest because you've got that southwest sky. It's
absolutely
fabulous for the south,
absolutely,
of course, if there's not too much haze.
Right, right.
But the south, they've been having, colder nights and colder mornings these days. So,
well, the cold is actually good for stargazing.
Yeah, right.
It's fantastic. As you go outside, the cold will knock out all of the humidity from the air, and all of a sudden you've got clear, clear, clear skies and a nice dark background. And it's really quite beautiful. And one fun thing that I like to do, when I go out in public and talk to people about it in the public, I always have people try to determine which star in the sky is actually a planet. And the one thing I do is I say, well, okay, hold your hand out at arm's length and close one eye, put your thumb up, and try to cover up a star. If you move your thumb really slowly across the star in the sky, and it blinks out, just goes pop, blinks out, then it's a star. But if it dims out, then it's a planet.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Because a planet in the sky is a little tiny disk. It's a very tiny disk. A star is so far away, it's like a true point. But a planet's like a little disk. So as you cover the disk up, you cover little bits of the
light.
It's
like an eclipse.
It's like a thumb eclipse, exactly.
So this is not significant in any way in the sense that it's,
Right.
But it does allow you to compare the planets. I mean, you
absolutely
can sort of move and see the rings see the moons of Jupiter and all that.
A couple of mornings ago, I actually was outside with my telescope in Inwood Hill Park, and I was able to see the rings of Saturn very easily. I saw Jupiter's moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and the bands across Jupiter, the atmosphere. It's quite crystal clear.
And Mercury?
Mercury's
got a big M on it.
Yeah, it's got a huge M. It's labeled in the sky, so you can't miss it.
Yeah.
Actually, you got to really wait until Mercury is very far away from the sun in order to have a good chance at it. What I would suggest for people across the U.S. is go to NASA's Night Sky Network, and that's a website. JPL does it out of Pasadena, and you can find amateur astronomy clubs all over the United States, and there's somebody you can call them up and say, hey, I want to try to find Mercury with you guys at greatest elongation on February 5 and 6. Maybe you can help me.
And if you can't find a local amateur astronomer, just come to Upper Manhattan and look for the guy in the bathrobe with the crowd around him in the morning, right, in the binoculars.
That's absolutely.
Jason Kendall, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Paterson University in Wayne, New Jersey. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've certainly gotten a hint that Barack Obama is looking forward to life after the White House. And Michelle Obama might just ditch D.C. altogether right now if her daughters weren't still in school. But there's nothing preventing Joe Biden from serving a third term, right? You know, being vice president in the United States was once so unattractive, it was likened to a political neutering job. John F. Kennedy derided Lyndon Johnson as Colonel Cornpone after naming him vice president. Eisenhower had little respect for Richard Nixon. FDR's VPs were ticket balancing asterisks until one of them, Harry Truman, became president after Roosevelt's death. Nixon and George Bush were so seemingly scarred by being vice presidents themselves that their own VPs, Spiro Agnew and Dan Quayle, were answers to trivia questions from the start. Then Dick Cheney turned the vice presidency into a Kaiser Soze shadow president under George W. Bush. And suddenly, was this a great job or still a joke?
People make jokes about the prize president.
Oh, look.
Jokes about the office all the time.
Sure, they should. Look, the vice No, they really should. There is no inherent power in the vice presidency.
Joe Biden followed Dick Cheney, and the question is Joe Biden having the time of his life now and for the last 8 years? He hasn't quite made it into an episode of South Park like Dick Cheney did. Biden's scene got deleted in the one episode he was slated to be in. Biden had better luck appearing live in Parks and Recreation.
And Dave told me you were going to be coming by, and you must be Leslie Knope. Welcome. Welcome.
My name just came out of your mouth.
Well, yeah, it did.
Well, this isn't happening. This isn't real.
No, it's happening, and I'm delighted to have you here. On behalf of the president and myself, I want to...
Oh, Mr. Vice President, I am deeply flattered, but there's no way that I could take over Madam Secretary Clinton's position. I mean...
I'm confident you could do that job or any other, but...
Okay, I will.
I once met the vice president, and in talking about Lyndon Johnson's biography by Robert Caro, which meticulously chronicles LBJ's misery as vice president, I asked him if he was having a better time than his Texas predecessor from the 1960s. Biden seemed very up on Johnson, shook his head, and said, "Oh, I'm having a much, much better time." So does anybody think that after deciding not to run for president in 2016, Biden might just want to stay put as vice president? Offer to become a Veep for life, potentially shake up the 2016 race one more time?
He's very popular. He works well across the aisle with the opposition party.
That's Professor Ronald Feynman, a member of the History Department at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. He's leading a small but visible draft campaign on his blog to get Joe B. to stick around.
He has loads of experience. He's had more years in government than anybody. He's in his 44th year in government now, and he's been chairman in the past of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee, and world leaders know him, and he's just a very popular and genuine and real, sincere guy. And even if people don't agree with him, like Mitch McConnell, for instance, the majority leader, or Lindsey Graham, they like him. Everybody likes Joe Biden, and I think even foreign leaders, and I think that's a plus.
Vice president for life?
Well, not for life, but for a third term, meaning, you know, I'm certainly not for life. But the point is, there is no constitutional amendment that prevents a vice president from serving more than two terms. While we do have the 22nd Amendment that prevents more than two terms for any president.
What about if a Republican is elected? Maybe your argument also applies there.
Well, I would think it could, but I don't think it probably would with the Republican Party as it is today. The only one I could even imagine of those candidates who might consider him would be someone who, like him, has tremendous experience and background and really is the best qualified based on that, and that is Governor John Kasich of Ohio. But I'm not sure he would be willing to create a ticket like that, but it would be a good ticket, certainly. Certainly it would be. But on the other hand, I don't think Joe Biden would agree to run against his own party's candidate. So that's why that's a scenario that really could not happen.
Do you think this is a strategic advantage for Hillary Clinton to bring Biden on the ticket? Would this be a headline that would really give her a bounce? She kind of needs a bounce right now.
I would say yes. I think it really would. I mean, I think she's in trouble. And honestly, if the emails controversy becomes more complicated, it could be that possibly we might have Joe Biden enter the race as an alternative, even belatedly, you know, because the Democrats really want to make sure they do hold the White House, because the Supreme Court is the crucial issue above anything else. The next president will be picking almost certainly 2 to 4 Supreme Court justices. So certainly from the party viewpoint, it's essential that a Democrat be elected. And I think Joe Biden would help to ensure that.
Have you run this by the vice president or his people?
I've never met him, to be honest. I would love to have met him. But in theory, one more year from today, if anything, God forbid, you know, went awry, he would be president. So he's always been very close to a position of power and influence. And I just think he would be an excellent president if that happened, God forbid, this year or if he was elected. But I really think the vice presidency would be a great position for him. And I think he would not turn it down if it was offered to him.
So what do you think Biden's advantage would be besides his resume? Right now, for instance, he's just been assigned to a mission to oversee a new Obama initiative to cure cancer.
Yes, although I don't think he'll get it done this year. But the fact that he's working on a cure for cancer and that he's committed to it, as he's always been committed to everything he does in his career, I think that it could really have an impact, and it could make him look good at the time of the convention. But there's almost nobody better at campaigning than Joe Biden. He inspires audiences. He attracts people. I think he could match up with anything that Donald Trump has done, you know, or even Bernie Sanders. He has a lot of people who love to come to see him. And, you know, he has real credentials that there's no debate about. Now, of course, I point out he's not perfect. He makes blunders. He makes silly mistakes sometimes, or silly statements. But that's human. But he doesn't really do anything that harms. And I would point out that his foreign policy ideas, I think, really make a lot of sense.
You said at one point that if he was asked, he would do it. How do you know that?
I just sense it. I think I know him well enough, even though I don't know him personally. I don't see him turning down that opportunity because I don't see him wanting to retire. I just think if not that, he'd want to be, you know, he hopefully would get a cabinet position like Secretary of State. I think he'd be flattered by it and would be very appreciative.
So you just got a feeling on this, and
yes,
and you're going with it.
Yes, and one thing I have to say is, in my whole adult life, there's been very few politicians that I really admired. You know, again, everybody's got faults, but I really admired. And the first one early in my life was Hubert Humphrey. I absolutely thought Hubert Humphrey was great. And although no two people are the same, I see Joe Biden as, in many ways, an inheritor of the kind of personality and inspiration and passion that Hubert Humphrey had. And that's why I've always admired him all these years of his career.
Professor Ronald Fineman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Ronald Fineman is a member of the History Department at Florida Atlantic University and author of Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency, from Andrew Jackson to Barack Obama. He writes the Progressive Professor blog. What do you think? Could Biden do with another 4 years? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org to have your say.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.